starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you. About living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in their hands. Watching the coast, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
Hello, and welcome to Spingola and Friends. It is Thursday, March 12th, 2015. This is Deanna Spingola from the Chicago, broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. This radio program does not have any corporate sponsors. Therefore, we can discuss issues that are more controversial. My website is spingola.com, where you will find information about my books, the Ruling Elite series, as well as my new book, Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences, which is now available on Amazon and from me in paperback, hardcover, and at Amazon you can acquire it in a Kindle version. Please visit screeningsandyhook.com for more information about the book. And it's actually a new blog. I've never used WordPress before, and so I'm just learning how to do that. And I think it'll be a good experience. Please also visit SpingolaSpeaks.net, created by a good friend and a listener who is very talented and posts all the recent audio files of my programs at that site, including the RBN files, the American Free Press files. Be sure and use the links at the top of the page to determine exactly where the files are, because I've done a lot of Spingola specials. So be sure and click all of those links, and also click on some of the other links that he has there, which are very, very interesting. My Twitter account is twitter.com/DeannaSpingola, and I hope that you will follow me. If you have questions or comments during the program, you may call in at 646-787-1915. And, of course, we also will take questions and comments via my email, comment@spingola.com. Or we invite you to join the chat room with our wonderful friendly chatters there, which is spingola.chatango.com. Alrighty, I mentioned on Monday that I was going to continue with the program that I had kind of started, and anyway, I'm going to be taking some selections from my third book, The Ruling Elite, Death, Destruction, and Domination, and then I'm also going to share some selections from The Myth of German Villainy by Benton L. Bradbury. And I've tried to get a hold of that author and have been unsuccessful. I did find an email for his son, but never heard back. So anyway, that book is terrific and well worth looking at, absolutely. So we will begin with The Ruling Elite, Death, Destruction, and Domination, which is, as I mentioned, available at Amazon and from me. All you have to do is go to my website. In 1928, Stalin replaced the new economical policy with the first of 13 five-year plans implemented on January 5, 1930, which imposed a shift from independent to collectivized farming. American firms with U.S. government knowledge and approval were involved in this new development in Russia. By the end of the first plan, the USSR had more than 4,538 tanks. Now, obviously, they were planning on further warfare. because, well, this is long before, well, it was before Hitler came to power. And so they were definitely planning on the industrialization and the militarization of the Soviet Union. The program continued with the second five-year plan. The Soviets produced furnaces, dug coal ore mines, and established huge electricity and oxygen plants. Under the first two plans, the Soviets produced 21,573 war plans. Under the third five-year plan, scheduled for completion in 1942, they intended to maintain massive production of high-quality armaments. Stalin, using terrorism, closed the country's borders to prevent escape from the USSR. The aim of the, and now I'm going to talk a little bit about the Ukrainians, and for that, well, wait a minute, let me just go back to my other, okay, yeah, I'm going to talk about the Ukrainians. I'm going to switch over to the Bradbury book, The Myth of German Villainy. The aim of the Ukrainian people, most of whom were peasant farmers, was, if not outright independence, then a high degree of autonomy within the Soviet Empire. Now, in my book, I give a very detailed background of the composition of the Ukrainian people, many of which were Germans who had settled in that area very early on. By this time, about 1929, Lenin had died, Trotsky was in exile, and Stalin was in control of the Soviet Union. Stalin was not a Jew himself. He was also not a Russian, but a Georgian. But the vast majority of the positions within the communist bureaucracy were filled by Jews, and most of those who surrounded Stalin were Jewish, including his main associate, Lazar Kaganovich. Stalin and Kaganovich were determined to crush this Ukrainian independence movement and collectivize Ukrainian agriculture with as much speed as possible. What Stalin and Kaganovich intended was the complete destruction of the traditional way of life in the Soviet Union, particularly in the Ukraine, and replace it with Marxist collectivism. The collectivization process was enormously disruptive for everyone and extremely unpopular. Though the collectivization process proceeded more or less on schedule in Russia, the Ukrainians resisted it to the point that the entire collectivization process in the Ukraine was brought to a standstill. The Ukrainian peasants refused to cooperate and even slaughtered their farm animals rather than hand them over to the state. Stalin and Kaganovich would not stand for this. In 1932, they unleashed a terror campaign against the Ukrainians, the brutality of which was unprecedented. 25,000 fanatical young party militants were sent in to force the 10 million Ukrainian peasants onto the collective farms. When these 25,000 young militants proved insufficient for the job, a large Cheka force was ordered in to begin mass executions in order to intimidate the population. The resistance continued unabated, so an orgy of indiscriminate mass killing ensued. Quotas were even set for the numbers to be killed. When the Chekists failed to meet weekly execution quotas, Stalin sent in Lazar Kaganovich, his Jewish assistant, along with a caterer of other Jews, to take charge of the situation. The Jew, Yakovlev Epstein, was put in charge specifically of collectivization. Kaganovich set the shooting quota at 10,000 Ukrainians per week, but there was not enough Chekists to shoot that many people. So Kaganovich and Stalin decided on a much cheaper and much more efficient method of mass murder, starvation. Troops were sent in, and all seed stocks, grain, silage, and farm animals were confiscated from Ukrainian farms. Chekist agents and Red Army troops sealed all roads and rail lines, letting nothing in and nothing out. Anyone trying to leave was shot. farms were searched, and all food and fuel was confiscated. There was nothing left to eat. Anyone caught stealing food, even a handful of grain, was shot. Ukrainians began to die of hunger, cold, and sickness in large numbers. During the frigid winter of 1932-33, the mass starvation created by Kaganovich took a drastic toll. Ukrainians ate anything they could find, including their pets, leather boots and belts, tree bark, grass, and roots. Cannibalism became common. Children, their parents, even ate their children. The precise number of Ukrainians who died in this deliberate famine, as well as by Cheka shootings, remains unknown. But the KGB's own archives, which have recently been opened, show that at least 7 million Ukrainians died. Ukrainian historians say it was worse than that, and put the figure at 9 million. Fully 25% of the Ukrainian population was wiped out by this deliberate, man-made extermination famine. On top of this grim number in the Ukraine, millions of other peasant farmers across the rest of the Soviet Union were also starved to death or shot during this collectivization program. Stalin admitted to Churchill at one of their meetings during World War II that he had been forced to liquidate 10 million uncooperative peasants during the 1930s in order to achieve collectivization. When mass executions by the Cheka in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania were added in, the genocide of 3 million Muslims in the USSR, massacres of Cossacks and Volga Germans are added. The total comes to at least 40 million Christians murdered by the Bolshevik Jews during the time they controlled Russia. This orgy of mass murder in Russia was well publicized throughout Germany as well as the rest of Europe while it was happening, and it was also well known that it was done largely by the hand of the Jews. Bolshevism, communism, and Judaism were correctly conflated in the German mind to mean one and the same thing. It is little wonder that the German people felt fear and hostility toward the Jews and saw them as a threat to their own existence. In Chapter 6, we will end The Myth of German Villainy. And remember, it is by Benton L. Bradbury. Even though the Bolsheviks, headed by Lenin and Trotsky, were in complete control in Russia, they did not yet feel secure. They believed that unless socialist revolution swept over all of Europe, they could be rolled back and crushed by the military might of world capitalism. To this end, a Communist International, or Comintern, was organized, which was funded by the Russian government and backed by Jewish banks in America and Europe. The purpose of the Comintern was to foment communist revolution throughout Europe to bring down traditional regimes, which would then be replaced by Soviet socialist republics. The largest communist party and the principal member of the Comintern outside of Russia was in Germany, the membership of which was significantly 78% Jewish. The network of communist parties was established in every country in Europe, with its headquarters in Moscow, with the intention of seizing control of all of Europe and then the world. In each of these communist parties, Jews dominated and made up a majority of its membership, and they reported back to Jewish Bolsheviks who now ran Russia. It seemed clear that two cultures were now in a titanic struggle to determine the socio-economic and cultural future of Europe, one Jewish under the flag of communism and the other traditional Western Christian civilization. The first country outside of Russia to fall to the communists was Hungary. As a result of World War I, the ancient Austro-Hungarian Empire had dissolved into its constituent parts, leaving much of it in total disarray. Jewish Bolsheviks, funded and controlled by the Soviet Union-based Comintern, took advantage of the chaos in Hungary. By enlisting the cooperation of the Jewish population in Hungary, almost all of whom were either communist or sympathetic to communism, they overthrew the government in March 1919. They then imposed a reign of terror over Hungary, which lasted until August 12th of that same year under the leadership of the Jew Bela Kun, whose real name was Moritz Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, a native Hungarian, but an agent of Lenin. Kuhn had sent a Hungarian soldier. No, Kuhn had been a Hungarian soldier during the war and taken prisoner by the Russians. After the Bolsheviks took over Russia, because he was a Jew, Kuhn was released from prison and became a member of the Cheka. He was then sent to the Ukraine, where he participated in the murder of scores of thousands of Christian Ukrainians. Kuhn was then selected to undergo training to become a Bolshevik agent back in his home country of Hungary. All right, let me just quickly check the chat room to see if there are questions. Alrighty, I don't see any questions. Alrighty. The new Bolshevik regime, now in control of Hungary under Kuhn's leadership, was Jewish to the man, amounting yet another Jewish coup d'etat of a sovereign state. Hungary was then divided up into districts, and Jews were appointed as commissars for each district. Many of these Jews were crude thugs of the lowest type. One had been a janitor in a synagogue and now was a commissar of a district. That's kind of like a governor of a state in the United States, the districts were. Terror squads were organized and a red terror began in full swing, mimicking that which was occurring in Russia at the same time. All private property was nationalized. All industry was nationalized. Grain was expropriated from peasants by force, and the peasants were all herded onto collective farms. The army and the police force were eliminated and replaced by new Bolshevik terror squads. Now, I want you to think about what's happening in America, what has happened in America as I go through this selection. These Jewish Bolsheviks, keep in mind that the Israelis have trained a lot of the police forces in some of the major states in this country. These Jewish Bolsheviks then began a reign of terror against the Christian clergy, burning churches and murdering priests and pastors all over Hungary, landowners and their families, as well as other bourgeoisie, were hauled away in trucks and murdered by the thousands. Rapes became endemic. Red Army soldiers went around to the private homes of the upper class and forcefully took the most beautiful girls and young women, married or not, with them back to the barracks, where they kept them for weeks at a time. Inside the barracks, all the soldiers took their turns with them until they grew tired of them, whereupon they were replaced by a new roundup of captive sex slaves. Any who resisted were killed. Many of the girls committed suicide rather than face their families again. The full scope of this Jewish Bolshevik terror in Hungary can be understood by the following order given by one of the commissars. Remember that all the commissars were Jews, and he directed them, and I quote, "Do not shrink from the shedding of blood, for nothing worthwhile can be obtained without it. Without blood, there can be no terror, and without terror, there can be no dictatorship of the proletariat," unquote. This quote came from the book, The Evolution of Hungary and Its Place in European History, by Count Paul Tillucki, former Prime Minister of Hungary. The Bolsheviks abolished the right of trial and the right of defense. The charge of counter-revolutionary resulted in immediate execution, no matter how spurious the charge. Jewish tyranny was wreaking a terrible revenge upon Christian Hungary. Kuhn resorted to the usual Jewish Bolshevik propaganda methods to break down the sanctity of religion, patriotism, and morality in order to undermine the Hungarian culture. The conservative Christian morals of the Hungarian people were ridiculed, while debauchery and pornography were given full license. Boy, talk about the commonality with America. Miklos Horthy saves Hungary. Hungarian Rear Admiral Miklos Horthy formed a national army to fight the Bolsheviks who had taken over the country. In response to Bela Kun's Red Terror, Horthy launched his White Terror campaign against the Bolsheviks. With the aid of the Romanian army, Horthy managed to overthrow Kun and the Bolsheviks on August 1, 1919, and set up a new government under the Social Democratic Party, headed by Horthy. Kun managed to escape back to Russia. The Red Terror was over, and the Christians took control of their country back from the Jewish Bolsheviks. But the Jews had taken a dreadful toll on the country during the brief period they were in power. The brutality of the Jews toward the Hungarian people set off a virulent wave of anti-Semitism, and a wholesale massacre of Jews ensued across Hungary once they were removed from power. Jews numbered 5% of the population of Hungary, but held about half of the positions in trade, banking, and the professions. They completely dominated theater and film production and controlled most of the newspapers. In 1939, the Hungarian government enacted an anti-Jewish law that restricted Jewish participation in business and industry to 12% and to only 6% within the professions. Jews were also banned from holding public office and from holding leading positions in journalism, the theater, or in film. As the social and economic order began to crumble in Germany near war's end in 1918, the working classes, including many soldiers and sailors in uniform, began to question their unthinking patriotism that had tied them to the war effort up until then. A sense of frustration and anger was rising in the armed forces, but also in the factories and the mills back home over the German government's refusal to end the war. This developing attitude of rebelliousness was encouraged and egged on by communist revolutionary provocateurs, the majority of whom, as in all other cases, were Jews. From the beginning of the war, the British Navy had maintained a total naval blockade, preventing all food from entering Germany. By 1916, the German people began to starve. This starvation blockade eventually caused the deaths of a million German people and the horrific suffering of millions more. On October 30, 1918, the German High Command issued an order for the final desperate naval assault to break this inhuman starvation blockade. This was an independent decision by the Navy and was not sanctioned by the government, but it was the spark that set off the revolution in Germany. The war-weary German soldiers in the northern part of Kiel were becoming rebellious as a result of communist agitators. Such an attack against much more powerful British Navy, they believed, would have been suicidal. They were not willing to squander their lives in a pointless, futile Gotterdammerung, and rose in mutiny against their officers. Over 1,000 of the rebellious sailors were arrested, but 4 days later, the workers of Kiel, led by communist Jews, came to their rescue. A general strike was launched, and a mass demonstration freed the sailors. Following this success, 2,000 armed workers and sailors marched to the town hall, occupied it, and established a workers' and sailors' council, or Soviet, and took control of the city. The German Revolution had begun. From Kiel, the Workers' and Soldiers' Council movement, inspired by the Russian Revolution and instigated largely by Jews who were in close communication with their brethren in Russia, spread rapidly throughout Germany. Let me check the chat room for questions and comments. Hi, everyone. I'm very happy that you've all joined me. I appreciate the chatters very much. All righty. In the Ruhr Valley, the Industrial Army and even whole towns were brought under the control of councils, like the Soviets in Russia, an indication of Jewish influence. By November 7th, the revolution had reached Berlin. Strikes and marches in the capital culminated in a massive demonstration outside the Reichstag on November 9th. The old rulers were terrified by the scope and strength of the revolutionary movement and began to panic. The Kaiser finally saw the hopelessness of the situation. Under pressure from leftist politicians, he abdicated and slipped across the border into forced exile in the Netherlands. The old rulers turned to the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, to save them from the insurgent masses. The SPD was Germany's largest political party, which purported to represent the workers. Eager to placate the mass demonstration which was developing, SPD leader Philipp Scheidemann, declared on November 9, 1918, the creation of a German republic to replace the old monarchy. It was a calculated attempt to demobilize the mass movement by giving them what they wanted. On November 10th, a provisional government of various socialist groups was established, nominally answerable to the workers and soldiers' councils, or Soviets. The provisional government included both the far-left Independent Social Democratic Party, as well as the more centrist SPD. Combining these radically different groups within the same government, moreover, nominally subordinate to the Workers' and Soldiers' Council, was inherently an unstable situation, and the struggle that followed was dominated by the conflict between these factions. The USPD was led by two Jews, Hugo Haas, whose real name was Allenstein, and Karl Kautsky. The USPD was a coalition of leftist groups, which included the communists. The USPD soon broke apart and disbanded, with the far-left group known as the Spartacists leaving to form the Communist Party, while its more moderate members joined the SPD. The Spartacist group, the forerunner of the Communist Party, was led by the Jews, Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, who received their funding from the Communist International Comintern, based in Moscow. The Spartacists represented the vanguard of the revolution, especially in Berlin. The Spartacists found their support amongst the urban working class, but the great majority of the German people, especially the middle and upper classes, as well as the rural farmers, were conservative and unsympathetic to socialists of all stripes and were totally against the communists. Now, socialist in this context is Marxist. The political instability in Germany caused the old political structure to begin to fall apart all across the country. On November 7, 1918, the 700-year-old Wittelsbach monarchy fell in Bavaria, after which Bavaria was declared a free state by the communist Jew Kurt Eisner of the USDP. Eisner then became minister president of Bavaria. But on February 21, 1919, he was shot and killed by a German patriot, Count Anton von Arco auf Valley, who said of Eisner, and I quote, "Eisner is a Bolshevist, a Jew, he isn't German, he doesn't feel German, he subverts all patriotic thoughts and feelings, he is a traitor to this land," unquote. The killing of Eisner made the Count a hero to many Bavarians, though it did not stop the communists. After Eisner's assassination, the communists and anarchists seized power in Bavaria. A Soviet republic was formally proclaimed on April 6, 1919, but collapsed within 6 days due to the ineptitude of its leaders. But another communist Jew, Eugene Levine, was waiting in the wings and became the new head of the Soviet government. Levine took the usual communist steps, which included expropriating luxurious apartments and giving them to the homeless and placing factories under the ownership and control of the workers. Levine organized his own army called the Red Army, similar to the Red Army in Russia. Hordes of unemployed workers swarmed into the new Red Army until its numbers swelled to 20,000. Red guards then begin arresting suspected counter-revolutionaries, that is, those who oppose the communist takeover of the government, and executing them. Among those executed were Prince Gustav von Thurn and Taxis, and Countess Helle von Westarp. Bavaria's Red Terror was about to begin in imitation of those in Russia and Hungary. But before their Russian-like Red Terror could get off the ground, they were brought down by the right-wing patriotic forces. On May 3, 1919, a group of 9,000 German army soldiers operating independently of the government, combined with Freikorps units, which are volunteer paramilitary units made up of soldiers, officers and soldiers who had returned home from the war. And this totaled 30,000. They entered Munich and quickly put an end to the Soviet Socialist Republic of Bavaria. Some 1,000 Red Army soldiers were killed, and around 700 of those associated with the Soviet Republic were executed by the Freikorps, including Levine himself. The Freikorps saved Bavaria, and remember that Hitler was associated with this group of Freikorps, okay? On January 5th, 1919, the Communist Spartacus uprising began in Berlin, led by Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, both Jews, which I mentioned. Communists formed paramilitary units, which they called the Red Army, modeled as usual after the Bolshevik Red Army in Russia. These units were made up mainly of armed revolutionary gangs of workers with no military experience. Bloody street fighting raged throughout the city between the Spartacus and the police, and of course between the Freikorps. The government was moved to the city of Weimar because of the fighting in Berlin. Freikorps units were then brought in to put down the rebellion. The revolution quickly took on the character of a civil war, with the communists and Bolsheviks on one side and conservative, traditional, middle, and upper-class Germans on the other. Bloody street battles also occurred in other German cities and towns between the communist Red Army and the police and the Freikorps. The communists, in typical fashion, began to assassinate political leaders and government officials and to organize strikes designed to cause the maximum damage to the already struggling economy. Barracks and naval dockyards, as well as other state properties, were seized, and street barricades divided Germany's cities and towns into political criminal fiefdoms. Workers' and soldiers' councils were formed in all of these cities, and officers and officials of the old regime were arrested and imprisoned. Kings and princes all over Germany abdicated and disappeared into exile. The untrained communist fighters were no match, however, for the disciplined, combat-experienced Freikorps, so the rebellion was quickly brought down. No mercy was shown to communist revolutionaries. Thousands were killed, and both Luxemburg and Liebknecht were executed by the Freikorps. As a result of this defeat, the communist movement temporarily collapsed, and the revolution ended in August 1919 with the inauguration of the Weimar Republic, headed by Friedrich Ebert of the Social Democratic Party. These communist uprisings had been put down not by the Weimar government, but by independently operating paramilitary groups of patriotic Germans known as the Freikorps. Maybe what this country needs is a bunch of patriotic people known as the Freikorps. Freikorps units had sprung up all over Germany in reaction to the communist threat to the country, and as stated above, were comprised mainly of soldiers who had returned from the war. They were led by ex-officers and tended to be nationalistic, patriotic, and ultra-conservative in character. Just a thought that I'm going to interject here. When you look at what is happening to our military, when you look at how the government and the psychiatric industry are giving out all of these psych drugs, psych cocktails. Some of the military are on 3 and 4 psych drugs. This totally, totally destroys them, marginalizes them. 8,000 of them per year, at least, commit suicide. This is what is happening to our military. When they come home from the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, they are made incapable of rising up against what we're dealing with in our government today. Alrighty. Unlike the Red Army opponents, the Free Corps were highly organized, and the officers who led them had the unswerving loyalty of the enlisted members. They were united in their hostility towards the communists and were used unofficially by the Weimar government to put down left-wing revolts and uprisings in cities throughout Germany. Some of these units were eventually absorbed into the National Socialist movement. Though the revolution was over, Germany was left in the grip of paranoia caused by the bitter reality of defeat in the World War, as well as the vindictive and punitive peace treaty which followed, but also by the frightening specter of a Bolshevik takeover of Germany like that which had occurred in Russia. The German people were well aware of the role played by the Jews in the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia as well as in Hungary, and they were well aware of the over-representation of the Jews in the Communist Revolution in Germany, which had only just ended. After the Bolsheviks had seized power and seized control in Russia, an opposing army was raised, led by Tsarist officers. They called themselves the White Army, in opposition to the Bolshevik Red Army. Their slogan became, "Kill the Jews and save Russia," quote unquote. Russia was now engaged in a civil war, the brutality of which knew no bounds, and the tentacles of the emerging internationalism of communism were spreading out of Russia like a giant octopus into every corner of Europe. The revolution, which had just been put down by the Free Corps, could well have ended with a Bolshevik takeover of Germany. The German people were convinced of a Jewish Bolshevik conspiracy against Western Christian civilization and its existential threat to Germany. A widespread surge of anti-Semitism developed among the German people as a result, combined with a distinct shift to the right in German public opinion. Let me just glance in the chat room here and see what's going on. Let me see if there's callers. No callers. Alrighty. On July 2nd, I mentioned that there's widespread surge of anti-Semitism developed among the German people as a result, combined with a distinct shift to the right in German public opinion. On July 2nd, 1922, in an interview while in exile with a reporter from the Chicago Tribune, Kaiser Wilhelm II said, and I quote, "The Jews are responsible for Bolshevism in Russia and Germany too. I was far too indulgent with them during my reign, and I bitterly regret the favors I showed to prominent Jewish bankers," unquote. British intelligence had discerned a coordinated Jewish communist revolutionary effort even before the beginning of World War I. In the July 16th, 1913 issue of the Great Britain Directorate of Intelligence, a monthly review of the progress of revolutionary movements abroad, an article stated, and I quote, "There is now definite evidence that Bolshevism is an international movement controlled by Jews. Communications are passing between the leaders in America, France, Russia, and England with a view to concerted action," unquote. The Jews had traditionally maintained well-established, high-efficient international networks through which information of interest to Jews was quickly passed. And this occurred as early as the night. It occurred way before the so-called civil war in this country. Okay, back to reading. Adolf Hitler looked back on the period several years later and described the situation in Germany this way, and I quote, "Germany with more than 6 million communists, was on the verge of a catastrophe which none but those wanting in common sense can possibly ignore. If red terrorism was to have swept over Germany, the Western countries of Europe would probably also have realized that it was not a matter of indifference to them whether the outpost of a destructive Asian world power stand guard on the Rhine and on the North Sea, or whether the land is populated by peaceful German peasants and working men whose only wish is to make an honest living and to be on friendly terms with other nations. By averting this disaster, which was threatening to ruin Germany, the National Socialist movement saved not only the German people, but also rendered the rest of Europe a service of historical merit. The National Socialist Revolution has but one aim: to restore order in our country, to provide work and bread for our starving masses, and to lay down the ideas of honor, loyalty, and decency as being the basis of our moral code, which, far from doing harm to other nations, can be for the benefit of all. Unquote. After the World War, World War I, Bolshevism also threatened Italy, Jewish communist agitators, supported and paid for by Red Russia's Comintern, provoked conflicts and committed terrorist acts in an attempt to bring down the Italian government and establish a Bolshevik government in its place. Mussolini formed his fascist party, to oppose the communists, and the struggle between the communists and the fascists cost thousands of lives in Italy. Jewish-led communists committed mass murders in Sarana, Modena, Bologna, Treviso, Diana, and Milan, but were eventually defeated by Mussolini's fascist forces. The final defeat of the Bolsheviks in Italy culminated in Mussolini's famous march on Rome, which I mentioned on Monday. Mussolini, like all other fascists, had been defamed by war propaganda and by the Jewish-controlled mainstream media, but he was well thought of and widely admired by world leaders prior to the war. Typically, in the Jewish propaganda, he was portrayed as a bombastic, barbaric buffoon. One of fascism's bitterest enemies during World War II, Winston Churchill could not praise the fascists enough before the war began. He was especially impressed with Mussolini, and he was against communism at one point, but that quickly changed. Of Italian fascism, Italy has shown, Churchill said, and I quote, of Italian fascism, Italy has shown that there is a way of fighting the subversive forces which can rally the masses of the people, properly led, to value and wish to defend the honor and stability of civilized society. Hereafter, no great nation will be unprovided with an ultimate means of protection against the cancerous growth of Bolshevism. Unquote. And Churchill said this on November 11, 1938. A group of British citizens living in Italy at the time of Mussolini's rise issued the following statement to contradict the false propaganda spewed out in the international Jewish press against Mussolini and the fascists. And I quote, "We wish to state most clearly and emphatically that there exists here today nothing that can be justly termed either tyranny or suppression of personal freedom as guaranteed by constitutional law in any civilized land. We believe that Mussolini enjoys the enthusiastic support and admiration of the Italian people, who are contented, orderly, and prosperous to a degree hitherto unknown in Italy and probably without parallel at the present time among other great European nations still suffering from the war." Unquote. And this was in the Financial Times in 1926. All righty, now let's switch to Spain. Red Russia's Comintern began arming and funding communism in Spain in 1936, which led to the bloody Spanish Civil War. Taking advantage of numerous national misfortunes, they transformed what had been the most conservative, staunchly Catholic monarchy in Europe into a nightmarish, atheistic, communist republic propped up by the Soviet Union. Communist in Europe was organized and led by Jews. Volunteers from all over the world, including Poland, France, Britain, Germany, Canada, and Palestine, joined the International Brigade to fight in Spain on the side of the communists. An inordinately high percentage of these were Jews. Jewish women volunteered as nurses. Yiddish language publications such as Der Freiheits Kämpfer and Batwin were published for all the Jewish volunteers in Spain. German volunteers formed the Thalmann Brigade, Italian the Garibaldi Brigade, French, the Commune de Paris. Americans formed the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. A highly disproportionate percentage of all these brigades were Jews. The Abraham Lincoln Brigade from America was led by the Jew Milton Wolfe. Mo Fishman was the leader of the veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade for years after the war. 70% of the medical personnel in the International Brigade were Jewish. Most of the Russian commanders were also Jews. Yakov Shmashkevich, I butchered that one, organized the Spanish Republican Air Force. He was a Jew. Grigory Stern was the chief military advisor to the Spanish Republic. General Manfred Stern was the commander of the International Brigade. And Liba Lazarevich Feldman, real name Alexander Orlov, was chief of Soviet security. All were Jews. Feldman, or Orlov, supervised the massacres of Catholic priests and nuns in Spain. The Jew, Mikhail Koltzov, was correspondent in Spain for Pravda, and Moses Rosenberg was the Soviet ambassador to Spain. The Red Terror in Spain took on the same character as the Red Terrors in Russia, Ukraine, Hungary, and Italy. The Jewish-led communists launched an orgy of mass murder, rape, and destruction. As they had attempted to wipe out Christianity in previous Red Terrors, they went after the Catholic Church in Spain with a vengeance. Over 20,000 churches across Spain were destroyed. 6,832 Spanish priests were murdered. 3,000 monks, 300 nuns, and 13 bishops were killed. In addition, some 4,000 laymen were murdered for helping or hiding nuns or priests. These murders were carried out with the usual torture and mutilation characteristic of other Red Terrors. General Francisco Franco, a staunch loyalist and devout Roman Catholic, stepped up to prevent the country from being another victim of communist revolution. He merged the Fanlangist and Carlist traditional Catholic monarchist rebels into a united national group and waged civil war against the so-called Republicans, who were now controlled by Moscow. In the Civil War, he had the support of Antonio Salazar in Portugal, Benito Mussolini in Italy, and Adolf Hitler in Germany. He overthrew the Republican Bolsheviks and saved Spain from Jewish Bolshevism. Franco has been branded a fascist by the international Jewish press, which means only that he opposed Jewish dominance and control of his country. In reality, he was the savior of Spain. Czechoslovakia was an artificial state created by the Paris Peace Conference after World War I. Its population was made up of several incompatible and contentious nationalities, including Czechs, Germans, Hungarians, Slovaks, Ruthenes, Slavs, and Jews, and was therefore unstable from the start. the capital city of Prague was home to 118,000 Jews, most of whom were communist or communist sympathizers. These Prague Jews were highly organized and openly sympathetic to Bolshevik Russia. The Czechoslovakian Communist Party, hang on, let me just check the chat room and see if there are some questions or comments. Am I not talking loud enough? Okay, let me see if I can make this louder. I'm not sure that I can. Okay. We have somebody that has nominated another member of the chat room as the leader of the Free Corps. Okay. Alrighty. Okay, the Czechoslovakian Communist Party, under the leadership of Bohumír Šmerl, Clement Gottwald, Rudolf Slansky, Václav Kopecký, and Josef Gutmann, et al., all Jews, was a member of the Moscow-based Communist International, or Comintern, and stood ready to instigate a communist revolution in Czechoslovakia whenever the opportunity might arise. After the German annexation of the Sudetenland in September 1938, Czechoslovakia fell apart along ethnic lines, with large populations and territories joining surrounding countries. The remaining remnant of the former Czechoslovakia, Bohemia, and Moravia, with its capital city of Prague, was totally defenseless and extremely vulnerable to a communist takeover. To prevent such a calamity, Hitler made Bohemia and Moravia a German protectorate. The warmongers in Britain, France, and the United States chose to see this move by Hitler as further proof of his ambitions to dominate all of Europe and even to conquer the world, instead of seeing it for what was a major measure to hold communism in check. And of course, Czechoslovakia was created. It was formerly part of the German Empire. So, anyway. All of European struggles against communism were of the same pattern. That is, each was a struggle of nationalist forces in each country against revolution, instigated and led by Jewish communists, paid for and supported by the Soviet Union's Communist International, Comintern, which was itself a Jewish organization. World domination as the goal of the Communist International was made clear in its documents, in which it was declared, and I quote, "The Communist International is the union of the communist parties of varying lands into a unified communist world party. As leader and organizer of the revolutionary movement of the world proletariat, the Communist International fights for the establishment of a worldwide dictatorship of the proletariat, for the establishment of a world union of socialist Soviet republics," unquote. The communist movement was unequivocally a Jewish movement, directed, controlled, and supported out of Moscow by the Jewish Bolsheviks who ruled Russia. Their goal was not only world domination, or at least domination of Western civilization, but also the complete eradication of Christianity and the deracination of Western culture, in other words, multiculturalism. The Russian writer Dostoevsky had this to say in his book, Diary of a Writer, published in 1877. and I quote, "It is not for nothing that everywhere in Europe the Jews are reigning over the stock exchanges. Not for nothing that they control capital. Not for nothing that they are masters of credit. And not for nothing, I repeat, that they are masters of all international politics. What is coming is the complete triumph of Jewish ideas, before which sentiments of humanity, the thirst for truth, Christian feelings, and the national and popular pride of Europe must bow. And what will be the future is known also to the Jews themselves. Their reign is approaching, their complete reign." Unquote. And his 1920 article, "Zionism versus Bolshevism, A Struggle for the Soul of the Jewish People," Winston Churchill stated his belief that, and I quote, "international Jews," unquote, "were seeking," and I quote, "a worldwide communistic state under Jewish domination," unquote. With the exception of Russia, the Jewish communist assault on Western Christian civilization was unsuccessful in every case where it was attempted, thanks to stalwarts like Horthy, Mussolini, Franco, and Hitler. They stopped communism in its tracks. Instead of being vilified and dismissed as repugnant fascist as they are today, the result of Jewish propaganda, these men should be held up as heroes and champions of Western Christian civilization, for that is what they were. It was inevitable that this great contest for the dominance of Europe would eventually culminate in a war between the Soviet Union, representing world Jewry, and Germany as the champion of Western Christian civilization. If Britain, France, and the United States had given Germany a free hand, or better yet, had supported Germany, then world communism would have been destroyed in its cradle, in which case the world would look very different today. Okay, now I'm going back to my book, Death, Destruction, The Ruling Elite, Death, Destruction, and Domination, and it is available at my website. I have it in paperback and hardcover, and of course it is also available at Amazon. You can also get a PDF file from me. I really like PDF files, and I also really like the Kindle because you can do a word search, which I really like word searches totally. Okay, and I'm going to pick it up where I left off on Monday, telling you just a little bit about Hitler's background. And, okay, we're going to talk a little bit about Freemasonry. Alrighty, let me check the chat room real quick and see if I have any emails, see if anybody's called in. Unlike RBN, my program on RBN, I wear all the hats here. I check the board to see who's called in. Okay, there's a caller. Let's take a caller. Let's take 661. Let me make you go live. 661, welcome.
Hi, Diana. This is Bethany Mifflin.
Well,
how are you?
How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. I was listening. It's so good to have all this information. God bless you.
Oh, well, thank you. I think we all need to... We need to know this stuff.
Diana, I mean, when you said about those great leaders that saved Europe, as if you're talking about the Arab homeland and
yes.
The great leaders like Saddam, Gaddafi, Nasser, Hawari, Boumediene, Yasser Arafat, who saved our land, was so vilified and executed by the same entity. I mean, as if when you're talking about those poor nuns and priests who were slaughtered by the same people, the same Zionist people. And those are the same people who are after us, and they are killing us now within all these Al-Qaeda and terrorists and ISIS. The same thing. Everybody who opposes the Zionist entity and their domination are being vilified and slaughtered hideously. So, I mean, I really, my tears came to my eyes when you talk about those leaders and how God bless their souls and how do they save Europe. And as if you are talking about the Arab world, I mean, his soul in highest heaven, Hitler and all those people. I mean, haven't been them, there will be no Arab world that during the 50s and 60s liberated our land from the British colony and all the other colonizers, and we made we get back our Arabic civilization and build our land, and we are living such a luxurious life before the Americans and their invasion came and destroyed our lands in many pretexts. And I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, it's such a similarity. I mean, you can't imagine. It's the same.
Exactly. So, that is why we need to study history, so that we can make comparisons. If we don't know history, we don't know how the Jews operated before in various countries, then we won't know that they're doing the same thing in your country and throughout the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, you see now all the Arab homeland, that's the real name of it, because they changed it to Middle East to create what's called the State of Israel or the Zionist entity. But all the Arab homeland now is boiling with the blood in Syria, in Iraq, in Libya, in everywhere. And that's the whole problem. So, I don't know. It's the same thing. I mean, you know that the false pretext, they came after Saddam, they vilified him. I mean, so much in the so-called U.S. media, he's a brutal, he's a demon.
Sure.
He killed his people, he stole the money. I mean, and all these falseless, I mean, everything baseless, very false, exactly the opposite. He's a great man, he's a father, he built Iraq from scratch, he made a big industry. He made a big farming, and Iraq was sufficient. We didn't want to. We don't import food. We started making our own food, making our own cars, making our own everything from the TVs till everything. So build a great industry, build a great civilization. Hundreds of thousands of scientists, hundreds of thousands of very qualified teachers, clean water. Iraq, we don't have poor at the time of the Ba'athist Party, Diana, we don't have poor people. I mean, we have middle class, in the terms we said high middle class, all of us high middle class, and we have somebody who is, I mean, a richer, that's it. We don't have salary. We don't have subsidized housing. Orphans have special, very, very, very luxurious special schools for the orphans. I mean, you can't imagine how great our living was. And then he was demonized and he was destroyed. And the Arab world was destroyed just like what the Zionists and the Talmudists did with our brothers and sisters in Europe in the 19th and 20th century. They are doing it to us. And when I grow up, Diana, we know also that World War I and World War II was to annihilate the Christian, white Christian. That's everybody, I mean, can tell you. And they say that. I mean, they say they annihilate Christianity in that century, and they are coming after us. That's what my grandfather was telling me. That's what my father was telling me. Exactly. They are coming after us. The great religious message of Muhammad, of Islam, they want to annihilate it. They want to substitute it with what? They want to destroy the tent of Islam, destroy the Arabs, destroy the great message of God. That Prophet Jesus alayhi salam, Prophet Muhammad alayhi salam, brought to this earth. So I mean, it's the same as if you are talking about my own people now. I mean, when I say my own people, all the Arab world.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
they don't change their tactics any.
Yeah. I mean, whenever you see some, like, I'll give you, for instance, now, where I told you what was happening in Iraq. 2003, U.S. came, destroyed Iraq, put a puppet government that the components of this government are sabotage people who use by U.K. and U.S. to make a sabotage act in Iraq at the Ba'athist time. Two, three parties, their own stooges, we call them. Their own stooges. And by the way, most of them are trained in Prague, in Czechoslovakia. Most of those stooges, their main headquarters in Prague. And they brought them, they call them a Dawa party, and those two Kurdish militia, and those, they call it Islam Brotherhood. Those are three components of the American stooges. They install them in Iraq, and those become the hand that U.S. Used to, I mean, really destroy Iraq, everything, loot everything, destroy everything, kill as many Iraqis from all, I mean, Christian, Sabian, Kurds, anybody who stands in against them. What happened at that time, 11 years of criminal acts against the Iraqi people. Iraqi people start revolting. They start revolting 2012, 2011, something like that. Nobody was hearing them. They revolt for I think from 2011 till 2014. The Maliki government start shooting the demonstrators, killing hundreds and hundreds of them. Then a big revolution started all over Iraq. At that time, what did Maliki and his masters in America? They create some Al Qaeda form thing, bunches of crook. They call them ISIS or whatever it is, mm-hmm. and they brought them to Iraq. And those ISIS start to kill the revolutionary. I mean, so those bunches of, I told you within a previous show that this guy they call al-Baghdadi, who's supposed to be the caliphate, mm-hmm. that's al-Baghdadi, his real name is Elliot Simpson. He's a Mossad agent.
Wow.
And he has many pictures with John McCain.
Oh, gosh.
Yes.
No surprise there. Oh, my gosh.
With John McCain in Syria, and you can see him without all this outfit. So when the Iraqi begin to revolt against al-Maliki, the so-called army and militia, those in the army, when we call it revolutionary tribes, they told to the army, they told them, look, we have no problem just with the Maliki because he imprisoned hundreds of thousands of us, even women and children. He's raping women and children and men in their prisons all over Iraq. Prisons all over Iraq. They kidnap people and take ransom and they kill them. The streets are filled with those unknown bodies. Torture cell everywhere in Iraq. I mean, it's a horrible thing. So when the people start revolting against the army, the people in the Iraqi army, those who have, Arab and Iraqis, if even Shiites, Sunni, anybody, they left the army, they went back, and they say, look, this is a problem between Maliki and those people. So most of the Iraqi army left them. They don't want to fight brothers against the brothers, because they know that Maliki is a tyrant man. So at that time, what did Maliki do with his American master? We start hurting ISIS, and ISIS is this, and ISIS is that, and you have seen all these videos about ISIS. By the way, all these videos that of the beheading of the ISIS from the first Israeli and the Arab world, we ridicule them, because we know all these movies of the beheading and the burning of this Jordanian pilot. These videos are made by a girl, a Jewish girl. His name is Katner or Katner. She has a production company called Side. And even she has a production company called Sight, and she made all these movies about the beheading. Whenever you see somebody with orange outfit, that means and get beheaded, that means this girl Katniss, which is Jewess, and her father Diana, her father was an Israeli spy who was executed in the late 50s, either in Syria or in Iraq. The owner of the production movie that made all the movie from the burning and beheading and I don't know what, whatever movie you see about ISIS, this is product or production by this company site and this Jewish girl, whom her father is an Israeli spy who was executed by an Arab state. So they began to fan all this. ISIS is bad. ISIS beheading. ISIS. And they rally even the Arab, of course, all. I mean, most of the government in that area in the Middle East are under the influence of the American, like Turkey and Jordan and Qatar and all the so-called Saudi Arabia. All these countries are under the influence of the U.S. So they can say no to U.S. So they're sending their pilots, they're sending their troops, they're sending whatever to help the tyrant government in Iraq, killing the Iraqi people who are revolting against their tyranny, and using the excuse of ISIS. ISIS is a bunch of criminals who then send them here and there to kill the revolutionaries themselves, to destroy like our relics, to destroy
culture. Yeah, your whole culture.
Yeah, so you see, so I create this fictitious, brutal people. So we need to go and kill them. But in fact, we are killing them. 1 minute, Diana.
Okay. Now
what happened that they're killing the people who are revolting against any stooges by using all these actions and all these propaganda, where are even in the Arab world, this is propaganda. So that's what's happening now in Iraq. I'm sorry I took too much time off you.
No, that's all right. I'm just so appreciative of your information because I feel that it's well, you reveal a lot of things to our listeners, and I really appreciate your call. I always appreciate hearing from you.
Thank you, honey. And one more thing I want to just make the people understand about the role of Iran in sabotaging Iraq. You know, Iran is our prehistorical enemy from the time of Babylon and Assyria and all that. Mm-hmm. Iran was always influenced by UK. I mean, who owns Iran? UK owns Iran completely. You know, British.
Mm-hmm.
Who owns everything in Iran? British Petroleum own Iran. In the 50s of the last century, Mossadegh, a very socialist man, came and nationalized the oil of Iran. It's for the Iranian people. Immediately after nationalizing the Iranian oil, Mossadegh was toppled. And he was vilified, and he was just like what they did to Saddam, they did to him. And then the American army came, the Americans, they came and took him out of the palace, and they put him in place, and he died after that, and they installed the Shah.
Yes.
From a civilized family. Western, like he influenced by the Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to do his best. They forced him to fund the Talabani and Barzani militia to kill the Iraqis in the north, especially the Iraqi army, the Iraqi policemen, all, even the Kurds who deal with the Iraqi government. So he was fighting the militia from the 50s, the Shah. Then the Shah came to understand that he wants to do something for his own people. First, he wants to take some of the money of Iran that's taken by the British Petroleum and make education more available and eradicate illiteracy. He wanted that. So British Petroleum said, no, we will not give you anything. He wanted to close the opium factory, the drug factory that's rampaging the Iranian people and make them sick and make them, I mean, a lot of bad things. They didn't. He tried to do many things. He tried to make Iran just like another civilized country. So they didn't allow him. What they did, he began to act individually. He closed all the opium factory. He started cutting from his own, before giving the money to the British Petroleum, he started cutting and giving it to his own people. From that time, you start 1978, late, you start hearing about this, some kind of squabble or some kind of uprising in Iran. And mostly the uprising happened in certain different places in Iran, and then it moved to Tehran. And from that time, they start glamorizing their agent, who called Khomeini, who was living in Paris at that time. Glamorize him, glamorize him. He is the leader of the Muslim. He is the leader of. They took Iran out of real structure and try cover it with the cover of Islam, Shiitism, Islam. So they toppled themselves. He himself, Shah said, he said, they toppled me. America toppled me. They toppled him, and they put Khomeini in power. First thing, Khomeini, in 1979, when he reached Tehran, the first thing he said in the airport, this is the Iranian revolution, and we shall export the revolution to the Arab world. And the first thing we shall do, liberate Jerusalem marching through Baghdad, and we go to Jerusalem. And we should topple the Ba'athist infidel party. And from that time, we begin to hear the Ba'athist infidel party, the Ba'athist, and he began. At that time, a lot of personnel, army, in the army, in the Shah army, they were against this nonsense of Khomeini. So what did he do? He executed a lot. Khomeini came supported by the SAVAK, which is the Iranian intelligence controlled by UK and US. So they did a lot for him. The SAVAK is a very hideous intelligence to execute people, kill people. So he eliminates most of the prominent army, the big generals of Iran. Then with the rest, he opened a new front. He started sending his troops to Iraq to kill as many Iranian who oppose his regime. Kill them there. Go send them to. And that's how the Iran started. Iran started the war against Iraq from that time, 1980. That's, some a hint about the situation. So I just want to say Iran is controlled mostly by U.S., U.K. Whatever propaganda or enmity between Iran and the U.S. and U.K. is a false. Everything is a complete false. And I can mention a book. It's the Treacherous Alliance by Tati Party. And you can purchase this book and see the secret dealings between U.S., Israel, and the West. And you can see there is no enmity and everything controlled by them. So from that time, Iran put the Islamic clause on them. Why? To control the Arab world, to help U.S. and U.K., do what they can do to destroy the Arab world.
Sure. Now what is the name of the book?
Treacherous alliance, the secret dealing between Iran, Israel, I think, and the West.
Okay.
Parti.
Okay.
And now, what U.S. is doing now, and John Kerry, by the way, you heard how much John Kerry and the Iranian government are in close contact and cooperation now to deal with the so-called ISIS. And the Iranian artillery starts, most of the fights now in Iraq, Diana, it's between the Iraqi people and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. You know that?
Huh. We didn't, yeah.
Now, Iran, now the main fighter now, not U.S. troops, not the U.K. troops, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. Now we have 30,000 fighters with their artillery fighting in Tikrit and Salah ad-Din now on the control of U.S. Personnel. We have we have 1,000 or less U.S. Combat people there. And all of them, they are fighting under Dempsey, Staff General Dempsey. But most of the fighters are Iranian. So now
wow.
We Tikrit.
Well, we're gonna have to do a program on this, Pufena.
Yeah, honey, I'm sorry I'm taking time.
That's okay, but I do need to get back to. Thanks.
One more thing, John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary, the U.S.
Uh-huh.
Foreign Secretary, his daughter-in-law married to an Iranian doctor.
Ah, that's interesting. Very interesting.
Thank you, Diana. Thank you. I'm sorry I'm taking. We should.
Oh, that's okay. You have a lot to share. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for you, and thanks for your listeners. Bye bye, dear.
Bye bye. Thank you. All righty. That was so nice to hear from her. She's delightful. Anyway, let's talk just a little bit about the Masonic Brotherhood, the Worldwide Masonic Brotherhood. This is from my book, Death, Destruction, and Domination. Albert Mackey's Lexicon of Freemasonry states that the religion of Freemasons is not Christianity. That's a quote. It is not Christianity. Author Yuri Lina and other researchers verify that the Freemasons participate in occult demonism and Satanism. Rabbi Stephen S. Wise affirmed, and I quote, "Freemasonry is a Jewish establishment whose history, grades, official appointments, passwords, and explanations are Jewish from beginning to end," unquote. Albert Pike admitted that the Jewish philosophy found in the Kabbalah is the foundation of Freemasonry. In 1903, Halimar Schacht joined the Dresdner, there's a little background in this guy, where he was a deputy director from 1908 to 1915. For years, his father lived in the United States, where he worked for the Morgan Control Equitable Trust Company on Wall Street, and then in its Berlin office. Because of this, the younger Schacht spoke fluent English. In 1905, during a business trip to the United States with the bank's board members, he met J. Pierpont Morgan and President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1908, Schacht became a Freemason when Montague Norman, his protege, invited him to join the order. Schacht's father was also a Freemason. In October 1914, General Carl von Lum, a former member of the board of directors of the Reichsbank and then general commissar for the bank in Belgium, had assigned Schacht to the staff of the banking commissioner for occupied Belgium to supervise financing of Germany's purchases in Belgium. Von Lum dismissed him in July 1915 when he discovered that Schacht, in payment for that merchandise, had channeled 500 million francs through the Dresdner Bank at a significant discount. in November 1918, along with Walter Rathenau, Schacht would help found the German Democratic Party. Now, Dieter Schwartz wrote that, and I quote, "Freemasonry is an ideological form of hostility to National Socialism," unquote, and that it, quote, "corrupts the principles of all forms of government based on racial and folkish considerations, enables the Jews to achieve social and political equality, and paves the way for Jewish radicalism through its support for the principles of freedom, equality, and brotherhood, the solidarity of folks, the League of Nations, and pacifism, and the rejection of all racial differences. With the help of its international connections and entanglements, Freemasonry interferes in the foreign policy relationship of all folks and pursues, through governmental leaders, secret foreign and world policies which escape the control of those in government." And that was a quote from Dieter Schwartz. Okay, during World War I, German Freemasons created field lodges where members could meet for lodge work. Some of the top German brothers met with Freemasons in the Belgian Lodge. Reportedly, Captain Adolf Hetzel met with Belgian brothers in League, where they expressed their mutual brotherhood despite the war. Captain Hetzel apparently had greater loyalty to Freemasonry than to Germany, inasmuch as he fraternized in a foreign lodge as a German officer with Germany's enemies. The Grand Lodge did not disapprove of this obvious conflict of national interest. On March 15, 1915, German Freemasons founded a field lodge in France to fraternize with their French brothers, making their Masonic commonality more important than the people who were dying and killing in the war. During World War I, Baron Rudolf von Siebatendorf founded the Munich branch of the Thule Society, a Volkish, not occult, Germanic study group named for a mythical northern country from Greek legend. The Baron and Walter Neuhaus, the society's founder, recruited 250 Munich residents, doctors, lawyers, judges, police officers, industrialists, professors, and other respected aristocrats, and about 1,500 from throughout Bavaria. Many of the founders were former members of the Progressive People's Party. According to Siebatendorf, members were more concerned about racism and preventing Jewish and communist influence than they were interested in pursuing Germanic studies. In October 1918, the Thule Society bought a local newspaper and soon changed its name to the People's Observer. In December 1918, Siebatendorf planned to kidnap Kurt Eisner, the Bavarian prime minister, and a Jew, but the plan fell through. Eisner had organized the Socialist Revolution, should be the Marxist Revolution, that topped the Wittelbach monarchy in Bavaria in November 1918. During the Bavarian Revolution of April 1919, officials accused the Thule Society members of attempting to infiltrate the state government. So they always put the blame on somebody else. On April 26, Munich's communist government entered the Thule facility and took seven members into custody, including Neuhaus, executing them on April 30th. The Thule Society sponsored the Deutsch, the DAP, which was founded January 5th, 1919, by Karl Herrer, a Thulist, and Anton Drexler, Gottfried Vedder, and Dietrich Eckart, one of the numerous parties in post-war Germany. Drexler had strong connections to right-wing workers' organizations in Munich. By then, Siebatendorf had left the society and did not join the DAP or the NSDAP. There is no evidence, get this, there is no evidence that Hitler ever joined or even attended a Thule Society meeting, though many of its members were enthusiastic about him. Herrer, the editor of the newspaper, left the party on January 5, 1920. Herrer, unlike Hitler, wished to maintain the DAP as a secret group like the Thule Society. By the end of February 1920, Hitler had transformed the party into the National Socialist German Workers' Party, NSDAP. Diedrich Bronder, a Jew, wrote Before Hitler Came, which was probably one of the original sources of the deceptive claim that Eckart, Fetter, Hans Frank, Hermann Göring, Professor Karl Haushofer, Rudolf Hess, Heinrich Himmler, and Alfred Rosenberg were among numerous members of the Thule Society who became prominent in Germany. However, Nicholas Goodrich Clark, in his research, found that Fetter, Eckart, and Rosenberg visited the group only as guests during the Bavarian Revolution of 1918. Hess and Frank belonged to the society prior to their association with the NSDAP. Hitler expended little time on esoteric activities. In fact, a speech he made on September 6, 1938, shows that he disapproved of occultism. He attempted to obliterate Freemasonry in Germany and Austria. Rosenberg wrote numerous articles about Freemasonry and commented on it in his book, Myths of the 20th Century. In 1922, he wrote an article titled The Crime of the Freemasons. After Hitler came to power in 1933, Reich Marshal Göring began taking measures against German Freemasonry and informed the old Prussian lodges that they must discontinue their activities in National Socialist Germany. The NSDAP initiated policies against Freemasonry and would not employ former Freemasons as officers or military officials, or in any state or municipal capacity. While the party did not dismiss Masonic personnel, it monitored their activities. National Socialism systematically sought to have Freemasons willingly dismantle their lodges. In other instances, police prohibitions limited their activities. Benito Mussolini, though an honorary Freemason, acknowledged that the Worldwide Brotherhood, a politically motivated entity answerable to the Grand Orient of France, was not as benign as he originally thought. He told the Freemasons in the Fascist Party to choose between the party and the Brotherhood. In late 1925, he disbanded Freemasonry in Italy. On February 13, 1923, the Grand Council of Fascists in Italy opposed the Green Snake, which is what they called it, and required all fascists to sever their Freemasonry connections. Then the government imposed laws like the Anti-Masonic Law of 1925 to destroy Masonry, causing many Italian Freemasons to emigrate. Grandmaster Torrigiani responded by attempting to ignite the animosity of international Freemasonry against fascist Germany, Italy. In 1925, Mussolini explained to the Italians, he said, Freemasonry is combated by fascists because it is an international organization which conducts its activity in Italy on the basis of orders which are issued in foreign countries. One cannot be a good Italian and simultaneously a Freemason because the Palazzo Giustiniani follows foreign directives, unquote. With regard to its past, Italian Freemasonry made claims similar to German Freemasonries, contending that the Freemasons implemented Italian unification, but Freemasonry had no part in the Italian nationalistic movement of the 19th century. Now, Walter Rathenau was an influential advocate of Jewish assimilation in Germany. He maintained that Jews should resist Zionism and socialism and unite within the society. Of course, he felt would eventually eliminate anti-Semitism. In 1921, the government appointed him as Minister of Reconstruction, and in 1922, he became Foreign Minister. He insisted that Germany should satisfy the obligations of the Versailles Treaty imposed while seeking a modification of its conditions. His attitude regarding this issue enraged German nationalists. On November 13, 1923, during the nation's hyperinflation, Helmar Schacht, never more than an honorary member of the NSDAP, became the special commissioner to stabilize the economy. Shortly thereafter, he became president of the Reichsbank, a post he held from 1923 to 1930. Schacht led the German delegation that negotiated the Young Plan for settlement of reparations after World War I. Owen Young, J.P. Morgan Jr., and his partner Thomas W. Lamont represented the United States. The meetings concluded on August 31, 1929, and the delegates officially adopted the plan at a second Hague Conference in January 1930. One of the provisions of the plan was the establishment of an international bank of settlements to manage reparations transfers, appropriately called the Bank for International Settlements. From May 4th to the 13th, 1933, Schacht, again the president of the Reichsbank because he had the credibility with world bankers, was in the United States visiting President Roosevelt and Secretary of State Cordell Hull regarding Germany's economic situation. Roosevelt expressed his concerns about the alleged persecution of Jews but wanted to repair financial ties. Schacht told Roosevelt that Germany, out of money, might default on its loans. This disturbed Hull, since this might affect the already depressed economy. During his visit, Schacht also met with David Sarnoff, president of RCA, and other leading Jews, including Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, and Sarnoff was Owen Young's assistant at the 1919 Paris Peace Conference. So, Schacht knew that whatever he said would not end the Jewish boycott that was crippling Germany's economy. Acting on behalf of the Foreign Policy Association, James McDonnell contacted Schacht at the end of his visit. He warned Schacht that France was considering invading and dividing Germany if the Germans continued their policies toward the Jews. Schacht relayed this information to Hitler after he boarded a ship to return to Germany. Hitler would dismiss Schacht from the Reichsbank presidency on January 20, 1939, and replace him with Walter Funk. The Allies later acquitted Schacht at Nuremberg. He was obviously working against his adopted country's policies, against what they were attempting to do. Elsewhere, outraged citizens rioted and destroyed, and getting back to Freemasonry. But you see, Schacht was a Freemason, as were probably Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, Sarnoff, and all these other people. And so you can see the influence that Freemasonry had over and above a person's loyalties or alliances with their own country that they were living in. So, elsewhere, outraged citizens rioted and destroyed lodge buildings. Large segments of the population were well aware of the threat that Freemasonry posed to the welfare of citizens. Freemasonry's ideology placed the security of the state in jeopardy. Lodges began closing their doors, often involuntarily. Some of them closed as early as March 1933, recognizing Hitler's animosity towards their activities. Freemasons also destroyed their lodge archives. Many still hoped to obtain influential government positions and expected that National Socialism was temporary. And I'm quite certain that Hitler was unaware. He used Schacht because of his previous association with other bankers in the world, and which was a benefit. for a time. Many of the humanitarian grand lodges had Jewish majorities. Government authorities made it patently obvious that they would not tolerate their activities and that Freemasons would have to dissolve their lodges or the state police would take action. Some of the old Prussian grand lodges altered their names and pretended to operate outside of Freemasonry, but these attempts proved unsatisfactory. By July 1935, the Freemasons had agreed to dissolve the old Prussian lodges. After changing many of the lodges to orders, Grand Masters told their charges to repudiate their Masonic affiliation when they joined the NSDAP. To integrate, many lodge members by January 30, 1933, had denied their affiliations, a key Masonic characteristic. Others accused the state of anti-Semitism and claimed that great men in German history had been champions of authentic Freemasonry. Freemasonry was hostile to fascism and to National Socialism. Freemasons waged a hate campaign against National Socialist Germany, especially after Hitler came to power. Jewish and other German immigrants joined the criticism of National Socialism. Prominent among the critics was George Bernhard, a Jew and a publisher of the Vossische Zeitung and the immigrant newspaper Parisian Daily, and Emil Julius Gumbel, a former professor in Heidelberg. Freemasons in America endorsed and promoted the anti-German defamation. Freemasons in France controlled the international body. They opposed the amalgamation of Austria and Germany, the return of the Sudetenland to Germany, and the creation of the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia. They were also behind the hateful attacks on Germany and Hitler. Freemasons in France also waged a rhetorical war against National Socialism. During International Masonic Congresses, officials created resolutions against National Socialist Germany, which they passed to the League of Nations. The Rothschilds failed to establish a world government at the Congress of Vienna in 1814 and 1815, but they established the League of Nations on April 28, 1919, during the Versailles Peace Conference. Many countries refused to accept this entity, with its pretense to end all wars, or to implement the stipulations of the treaty. While it existed, the future president of the World Zionist Congress, Nahum Sokolow, admitted, and I quote, "The League of Nations is a Jewish idea. We created it after a fight of 25 years, unquote. And again, for the peace of the world, a League of Nations let us have by all means, but for the humanity of the world to give justice to the Jews," unquote. The NSDAP's official policy, let me just check the chat room and see if there's any. Okay. No actual questions, just some comments. The NSDAP's official policy for party membership required that the applicant state upon his honor that he had never been a Freemason or a member of a Masonic lodge. The same prerequisite applied to NSD subsidiary organizations like the SA, the SS, and the NSKK, which was the motorized SA. Hitler, through an amnesty decree dated April 20th, 1938, made it possible for former Freemasons to remain in the party and its subsidiaries if they joined the party after January 30th, 1933, and prior to the regulation. This stipulation did not apply to the higher degree Freemasons or to those who held high lodge positions. The NSDAP did not permit them to remain in the party or its subsidiaries or allow these people to apply for membership. Freemasons in America, under the direction of a special committee in Paris, spent thousands of dollars to facilitate the immigration of Freemasons from Central Europe. Individuals in other nations collected huge sums, which they funneled to Freemasons in Spain to help finance the communists. The organization in France demonstrated Freemasonry's predominant influence when numerous political factions, including Republicans and Marxists, combined to reach an objective. During Spain's Civil War, Freemasons in France demanded their country's armed intervention on the side of the communists. After the Munich Accords, reached on September 29, 1938, by Neville Chamberlain, Edward Dalia, D-A-L-A-D-I-E-R, Mussolini, and Hitler, Freemasons in Britain demanded war with Germany and had the constant cooperation of Freemason Franklin D. Roosevelt. The Versailles Treaty mandated American intervention to back its stipulations. The Jewish-controlled press, closely linked with Freemasonry, fought against National Socialist Germany. In 1939, the war erupted as a continuation of those efforts using military force. Chamberlain and Daladier approved Germany's annexation of the Sudetenland. Hitler vowed that he would not demand any further territory in Europe. Thus, Hitler, Chamberlain, Daladier, and Mussolini signed the Munich Pact. Edvard Beneš, Czechoslovakia's head of state, objected to the decision. Chamberlain reminded Beneš that Britain would not go to war over the Sudetenland issue. Jews, with their unique exclusivity, constitute a state within a state. A government cannot serve the best interest of its citizens if Freemasonry exists within its borders. Freemasonry is incompatible with national independence. Freemasons, unified by their international objectives, infiltrate and hold prominent positions in economic, political, and spiritual organizations. This is dangerous because every Freemason is required to be a Freemason first, always acting in accordance with his Masonic instruction. A Masonic politician is always a Freemason first and a politician second, and thus is not accountable to his constituents or to the nation. National Socialism was different in that it embraced unconditional racial nationalism as opposed to the internationalism of Freemasonry and Judaism. German National Socialism focused on basic concepts of education beneficial to students and to the country, rather than on Masonic internationalism. So, let's just run through this. Christians, I'm skipping around here. Christians should not swear oaths, especially open-ended oaths. This applies to any blank check promise, such as a pledge of allegiance to a government that might require a citizen's participation in offensive wars in foreign countries. A citizen-created government owes allegiance to its citizens, not the other way around. A vow to the state essentially concedes permission for whatever the states decide to impose on its citizens. Unjust taxes, wealth redistribution, media censorship, restrictive regulations, imprisonment without cause, and numerous other unjust laws. Incrementally, Hitler's policies destroyed Freemasonry's influence in Germany. The lodges in Austria soon waned as well, breaking the Masonic world chain. As Germany occupied Poland, Norway, Belgium, and Luxembourg, members dissolved the lodges. The French government recognized that Freemasonry was partially culpable for France's defeat, and France eventually prohibited Masonic activity. War's disruption limited activity in southeastern Europe. However, Freemasons in Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, Britain, and especially in America, maintained considerable power. Freemasons in America exercised extensive influence in driving political opinion against National Socialism's new order in Europe. Freemasons collaborated with other enemies of National Socialism, with World Jewry, the political churches, and international Marxism. Many countries throughout history have forbidden Freemasonry, but in a time of crises, members of the Brotherhood had introduced the craft like poison with its liberalistic mentality into Germany. All righty, we have just about 10 minutes. Let me check the chat room and let me check my email and let me check the board. I have three places here to check. All righty. Okay, there it is. Would you believe there's an official history of Adolf Hitler? Okay, this is the beginning of another chapter, which I'm going to have to continue. I think I should continue this, having maybe two programs a week, so that we can talk about some of the historical factors that were involved in Europe. And I think it might be, I think the listeners might benefit from the historical perceptions that I'm giving. And I think that people who have believed some of the garbage about Hitler, this will be educational for them. So I'm countering all the myths, all the Hitler myths, even those Hitler myths that seem very apparent in the so-called alternative media. Okay, to put the right spin on America in the aftermath of World War I, a Committee on Public Information, the CPI, press team, including Edward Bernays, attended the Paris Peace Conference in 1918. George Creel wrote a book in 1920 titled How We Advertised America, in which he recounted the committee used the principles of advertising to convince Americans to go to war with Germany, unquote. Federal agencies were established, funded, and approved to work with the news media, Hollywood film studios, and magazines, virtually every communication vehicle. Those friendly, smiling TV and radio personalities of today may, in fact, be on the government's payroll, inspiring patriotic pro-war movies or Disney's animations evoke a predictable response. Many media personalities belong to the Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR, an organization devoted to destroying America. The Rockefeller and Sloan Foundations finance the official histories of World War II, paying CFR-associated establishment historians to develop these accounts to neutralize and discredit the facts revealed by non-establishment researchers. The revisionists could, and in this case, I'm using the word revisionist, because when you look at it logically, the non-establishment researchers are the real, they produce the real history. It's the revisionists who have created acceptable rhetoric for people eager to believe the best about their leaders. But in other terms, like today, we often call people who counter the official government version, we often refer to them as revisionists. So anyway, I just wanted to explain the context in which it is used. Okay, the revisionist could easily produce reasonably acceptable rhetoric for people eager to believe the best about their leaders, regardless of the overwhelming facts to the contrary. Citizens asked too many questions after World War I. An embarrassing situation that officials wanted to avoid after numerous discrepancies exposed by documents released during the Pearl Harbor investigations, strongly suggested that Roosevelt deceived America into war despite assurances that he would keep the country out of battle. And so I want you to understand that just about everything that we read in the newspapers, that we learned after World War II, that Hollywood movies introduced, that television personalities introduced, that the History Channel has said, that the so-called court historians have provided, are all a bunch of lies. Lies, lies, lies. Now, Hermann Göring and his wife Karin, C-A-R-I-N, a Swedish baroness, entertained some notable people at their residence on the outskirts of Berlin in the first week of January 1931. Their guests included Adolf Hitler, Fritz Thyssen, Ernst Tengelmann, Hjalmar Schacht and his wife, and the Prince and Princess Zu Wied, W-I-E-D, influential people who had not yet met Hitler. The prince joined the NSDAP on November 1st, 1929. Tengelmann was the director of a major coal mining operation in the Ruhr. In their book, Who Financed Hitler? The Secret Funding of Hitler's Rise to Power, James and Suzanne Poole repudiate the contention by other authors that Hitler was uncomfortable and even incapable of carrying on a conversation in small groups or with individuals. And so, even before he came to power, people were writing about him, were criticizing him, and even before the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, launched a smear campaign against Hitler, the Literary Digest, August 26, 1933, compared him to Charles Chaplin with his characteristic mustache and his bouncing way of walking. A writer in the London New Statesman commented, and I quote, "He was so regarding Hitler, he was so funny, I inquired who he might be, and suggested that Hitler was probably a trifle mentally deranged. Hitler's reputation was growing stronger in Germany, yet many European newspapers highlighted what they viewed as, and I quote, the comic aspects of Germany's dictator, unquote, portraying him as a, quote unquote, comedian with a, quote, an undefatigable sense of the theater, unquote, like an actor, quote unquote, manager, staging his big show with scraps of discarded ideas and unconsidered trifles." Now, this was before he even came to power. And so I will continue with this story and how all of these myths came about. And most of them were, as I mentioned, devised by the Office of Strategic Services, the Office of Strategic Services, and the newspapers in Europe, which were, of course, Jew-dominated. All righty. We are running out of time. We have 90 seconds. Let me just check in the chat room, see if there's any okay. All righty. Okay. Well, I thank you very much for joining me today, and thanks to the caller who called in. And for those people in the chat room who are who make comments and who are so supportive, thank you so very much. And I will talk to you soon. And take care. And be sure and join me Saturday on my RBN program. I have some interesting guests. So thank you so much. Take care. Start with you and me.